A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. The predicament of realizing a friendship isn't actually serving you when you're someone who struggles with boundaries in the first place. If you're wired to worry about hurting other people's feelings, you can end up tethered to relationships long past their expiration date. The question is how to diplomatically move away from older friends, and what to do when subtle signals just aren't getting through, which, honestly, is where most people get stuck.
This is one of those topics where the thing that feels kindest in the moment is often the cruelest in aggregate, and the research backs this up in ways that I think would surprise most people.
The slow fade feels like letting someone down easy, but what it actually does is keep them in a state of not knowing.
There was a study published in 2024 in the Journal of Social and Personal Relationships that looked at this directly. 78% of people who used the slow fade reported that the other person simply did not understand the message. They interpreted shorter replies as busyness, fewer calls as a stressful period at work, delayed responses as travel. The brain fills in the gap with the most optimistic interpretation available.
Because the alternative interpretation, this person is deliberately disengaging from me, is painful. So the receiving brain resists it until the evidence becomes overwhelming. Which is how you get people who are still texting you, 6 months after you thought you'd made yourself clear.
The flip side of that study, only 12% of people who had a direct conversation reported that the other person didn't understand. 12% versus 78. That's not a margin of error. That's a fundamental difference in signal clarity.
The slow fade isn't a kind of breakup. It's just a breakup that the other person doesn't know is happening yet.
That's the kindness paradox. And it shows up in negotiation theory, too. The idea that we systematically overestimate how much other people will be hurt by direct rejection, and we systematically underestimate how much clarity helps them move on.
Which is where the boundary-challenged person gets trapped. You're already someone who struggles to say no. So your instinct is to soften everything. Make it ambiguous. Leave room for the other person to save face. And that instinct is exactly what prolongs the whole thing.
Let's actually define the core problem here, because I think it's a systems issue, not a character flaw. People who have trouble setting boundaries tend to attract what researchers call taker friends. People who are happy to accept the one-way flow of emotional labor, favors, listening hours, whatever it is. Not because they're necessarily malicious, but because they found someone who won't stop them.
The taker isn't doing a cost-benefit analysis. They're just responding to the environment. If the door is always open, they'll keep walking through it.
And the emotional cost for the boundary-challenged person is cumulative. It starts as mild irritation, becomes resentment, and eventually hardens into something closer to burnout. But here's the part that doesn't get talked about enough. Staying in these friendships doesn't just drain you. It reinforces the belief that your needs don't matter. Every time you accept a call you don't want to take, or agree to plans you're dreading, you're training yourself that your own preferences are negotiable.
It becomes self-reinforcing. The longer you stay, the harder it is to leave, because leaving would mean admitting to yourself that you've been tolerating something you shouldn't have.
That's the sunk cost dimension of it. And it's not just emotional, there's an identity piece too. If you think of yourself as a loyal person, a reliable person, someone who doesn't abandon people, then ending a friendship feels like a betrayal of who you are. So you stay, not because the friendship is good, but because leaving would force you to update your self-image.
Which is way harder than just tolerating another tedious phone call.
And I think that's why so many people get stuck at the awareness stage. They know the friendship is draining them. They can articulate exactly why. But the gap between knowing and acting is bridged by self-image, and that's a heavy bridge to cross.
What you're saying is that the boundary-challenged person isn't just fighting discomfort with confrontation. They're fighting an identity crisis.
A small one, yes. And that's why the slow fade is so seductive. It lets you exit without ever having to say, "I am the kind of person who ends friendships." You can pretend it just.
The research says the other person doesn't perceive the drift.
so you're preserving your self-image at the cost of their clarity. And that's where the kindness paradox really bites.
Then there's the communication gap. This is where I think an information theory lens is actually useful. When you send a weak signal, slow replies, short answers, big excuses, the receiver's brain treats that signal as ambiguous. And ambiguous social signals activate the same neural pathways as uncertainty and threat detection. The Gottman Institute has research on this. The brain treats, maybe, as a stressor.
It makes evolutionary sense, right? If you're in an environment where social exclusion meant actual survival risk, an ambiguous signal from a group member was genuinely threatening. Are they pulling away? Am I being pushed out? Should I be preparing for that? The brain can't resolve the uncertainty, so it stays on alert.
You're not sparing them stress. You're creating a low-grade, chronic stress that they can't resolve because they don't have enough information.
The brain wants closure. Ambiguity denies it closure. So the other person keeps reaching out, trying to resolve the uncertainty, which is exactly what the boundary challenged person is trying to avoid.
What you've got is two people locked in a dynamic where one is slowly backing away while the other is slowly escalating their attempts to connect, and neither one is naming what's actually happening.
That's how you get the last straw explosion. When the boundary challenged person finally can't take it anymore and says something direct, the other person is often blindsided. Because from their perspective, everything seemed fine. You were just busy, you were just stressed, you were just going through something. The signals were too weak to register.
Of course there are. And the explosion is worse than if you just said something at month two.
Let me give you an example. There's a case study I came across. A woman I'll call Sarah. She spent 8 months reducing contact with a friend who only called to vent about her own problems. Sarah shortened the calls, took longer to respond, gave vague reasons she couldn't talk. The friend interpreted every single one of those signals as, Sarah is stressed right now. She kept calling. By month 8, Sarah finally snapped and said she couldn't do the friendship anymore. The friend was devastated, not just by the ending, but by the realization that Sarah had been trying to end it for the better part of a year without telling her.
The friend wasn't just hurt, she was humiliated. She'd been operating on bad information for 8 months.
That humiliation is what turns a sad ending into a dramatic one. If Sarah had had a direct conversation at month 2, it would have been uncomfortable for maybe a week. Instead, it was a rupture.
It's like finding out your partner has been planning to break up with you for a year but kept saying everything's fine at dinner. The betrayal isn't the breakup. The betrayal is the performance.
That's exactly the right analogy. And I think that's what people miss when they choose the slow fade. They think they're choosing between hurt them now and hurt them later. But they're actually choosing between hurt them with honesty and hurt them with dishonesty. The second one compounds.
Let's talk about the three escalation levels, because I think this is where people get stuck. They default to level 1 and never leave it.
Level 1 is passive reduction. You reply less, you initiate nothing, you're busy a lot. The problem is that level 1 is indistinguishable from actually being busy. It has zero informational content.
It's the social equivalent of hoping someone will notice you've stopped watering the plant.
Level 2 is active but indirect. This is where you start saying things like, I've been reevaluating my social commitments, or I'm trying to spend more time on my own these days. It's more direct, but it's still not naming the specific friendship. The other person can think you're talking about your general life philosophy, not about them.
Level 3 is the direct conversation. I valued our friendship, but I need to step back. Named, specific, unambiguous.
Most people live at level 1 indefinitely. And the research from that 2024 study shows why we overestimate how much our subtle signals will be understood. We think, I took 4 days to respond, is a clear message. It's not.
There was a Pew Research survey in 2023 that found 43% of adults under 35 have ended a friendship in the last 2 years, but only 22% had a direct conversation about it.
More than half of friendship endings among younger adults are happening through ambiguity. And I'd bet almost anything that the ambiguity group experienced more prolonged stress than the direct conversation group.
The math on that is pretty stark. If nearly half of young adults are ending friendships, but only 1 in 5 is actually saying the words, that's a lot of people marinating in unresolved social tension.
It connects to something deeper about how we think about friendship versus how we think about romantic relationships. We have cultural scripts for breaking up with a partner. We need to talk. It's not you, it's me. Clumsy as those scripts are, they exist. For friendships, there's almost no cultural script, which means people default to the only tool they have, ghosting or fading.
Because friendship is supposed to be effortless. That's the mythology. Good friendships shouldn't need maintenance, and they definitely shouldn't need formal endings.
Which is nonsense. Friendships are relationships. They have beginnings, middles, and sometimes ends. Pretending otherwise just leaves people unequipped.
The mythology creates this weird shame spiral. If you need to end a friendship, the mythology says there must be something wrong with you, because real friends don't do that, so you hide the ending even from yourself.
You frame it as, we just drifted apart, even when you were the one doing all the drifting. It's a way of avoiding the responsibility of making a choice.
Let's build the actual framework. If subtlety doesn't work, what does the direct conversation actually look like?
I think there's a 4-step protocol that's both kind and clear. And the order matters. Step 1 is what I'd call the gratitude bridge. You open with genuine appreciation for the friendship's history.
No thanks for being a great friend. That's a greeting card.
I've really valued our time together, especially those long conversations we used to have about books. Or, I'll always be grateful for how you showed up for me during that rough patch a few years ago. You're anchoring the conversation in what was good. This isn't manipulation, it's acknowledging that the friendship mattered even if it doesn't fit anymore.
It signals that you're not about to list their flaws for 45 minutes.
Step 2 is the I statement pivot. This is the crucial part. You state your own capacity, not their deficiencies. I've realized I have less social energy than I used to, and I need to be more intentional about where I invest it. Or, I'm in a season where I need to pull back from some social commitments to focus on other things.
The key word there is I. You're not saying you exhaust me. You're saying I have limited capacity.
That's not just tact, it's accuracy. The friendship isn't working because of who you both are, not because one of you is defective. Step 3 is the specific boundary. You name the change concretely. I won't be available for weekly calls anymore. I can do a check-in every few months. Or, I'm not going to be able to keep up with daily texting. I'll reach out when I can.
Specificity is mercy. I can do a check-in every few months is a clear offer. Let's hang out sometime, is not.
Step 4 is the soft landing. You leave the door slightly ajar if appropriate. I hope you understand, and I wish you well. Or, this isn't about anything you did wrong, it's just where I am right now.
Not every friendship deserves a soft landing, but for the ones that were good at some point, it's the right call.
Let me give you the script comparison, because I think this makes it concrete. The vague version is, I'm really busy these days, I'll let you know when things calm down. That's level 1. It's ambiguous, it invites follow-up, and it puts the burden on you to eventually calm down. The direct version is, I've realized I need to reduce my social commitments. I won't be able to maintain this friendship at the current level, but I valued our time together and I wish you well.
The second one is harder to say, but it ends the ambiguity. The first one just kicks the can down the road.
Here's the thing. The second one is also kinder, because it gives the other person information they can actually use. They can grieve the friendship and move on, rather than spending months wondering if you're mad at them or if they should keep trying.
What about when they push back? Because some people will.
This is where the broken record technique comes in. You repeat your boundary calmly without over-explaining. The other person says, but why? What did I do? Can we talk about this? And you say, I hear that you're hurt. I still need to step back.
The temptation is to list grievances. Well, since you asked, here are the 17 things.
Which is a trap. Over-explaining invites negotiation. If you give someone a list of reasons, they'll try to solve each one. Oh, I didn't realize I was calling too much. I'll call less. And now you're in a negotiation about the terms of a friendship you're trying to exit.
A boundary doesn't need a justification. It needs a statement.
That's the mindset shift. You're not asking permission. You're providing information.
There's another case study worth mentioning. Marcus, a guy who had a friend who kept texting after he'd stopped responding. He used the gratitude bridge plus the I statement pivot. The friend pushed back twice. Marcus repeated the boundary calmly both times. I appreciate you reaching out. I still need to step back. By the third repetition, the friend stopped.
That's about what it takes for the message to land when someone is invested in not hearing it.
Marcus said the hardest part wasn't the conversation itself. It was the first time he said the words out loud. He practiced with a voice memo app, and the first recording sounded terrible to him. By the 10th, it felt like truth.
That's such an important point. There's a desensitization process. The words feel cruel in your head because you've never said them before. But the more you practice, the more you realize they're just.
It's like rehearsing for a presentation. The first run-through is always a disaster. But by the time you're actually in the room, your brain has normalized the sentences. They're not shocking anymore. They're just words you've said before.
That's the piece people skip. They script the conversation in their head but never say it out loud, so the words retain their charge. The voice memo trick works because it forces you to hear yourself saying the thing. Your brain can't hide from your own voice the way it can hide from silent thoughts.
What about the question of when to skip the diplomacy entirely? When is a friendship not owed the four-step framework?
If the friendship is actively harmful, emotional manipulation, financial exploitation, consistent boundary violations that the person refuses to acknowledge, you skip the gratitude bridge and the soft landing. You state the boundary clearly and you don't negotiate. I'm not going to continue this friendship. I wish you well.
The gratitude bridge assumes there's something genuine to be grateful for. If someone has been exploiting you, manufacturing gratitude is just lying.
It undermines the boundary. If you open with appreciation for someone who's been manipulative, you're signaling that the manipulation was acceptable. It wasn't.
Let's talk about the why question, because that's the one that trips people up the most. What do you say when someone asks why and you don't want to list grievances?
The best answer is some version of, it's not about anything specific you did. This is about my capacity and where I am right now. And if they keep pushing, you can say, I don't think listing reasons would be helpful for either of us. I've made this decision, and I need you to respect it.
That last part, I need you to respect it, is powerful. It reframes the conversation. The question isn't whether your reasons are valid. The question is whether they can accept your decision.
If they can't accept your decision, that itself is information. Someone who refuses to accept a clearly stated boundary isn't someone you want in your life anyway.
There's a weird paradox there, too. The people who demand the most exhaustive explanations are often the ones who will use those explanations as ammunition. You said it was about capacity, but then I saw you at a party last weekend. The explanation becomes a trap.
Which is exactly why I don't think listing reasons would be helpful is such an important phrase. It's a boundary about the boundary. You're not just saying no to the friendship. You're saying no to the interrogation about the friendship.
We've got the framework, but knowing what to say and actually saying it are two different things. How do you bridge that gap?
I think there are three actionable things listeners can do. The first is to decide your line in the sand before any disengagement attempt. What specific behavior or frequency will trigger a direct conversation? Write it down. If I'm still dreading this person's calls after three more interactions, I'll have the conversation. Or, if I've been avoiding their messages for 2 weeks, that's my signal.
Which brings up the 2-week rule. If you've been avoiding someone's messages for more than 2 weeks, you owe them a direct conversation. The slow fade has already failed. You're not being kind. You're being avoidant.
The 2-week rule is a good heuristic because it forces a decision point. After 14 days of avoidance, the question isn't, should I say something? It's, what am I going to say?
The third actionable thing is to practice. Write the gratitude bridge and the I statement pivot for the specific person. Say it out loud to a trusted friend or record a voice memo. The first time you hear yourself say it, it'll feel terrible. By the 10th time, it'll feel like the obvious truth.
I'd actually encourage listeners to do this week. Identify one friendship that's draining you. Don't send anything, just write the script. Get the words out of your head and onto paper. That alone reduces the anxiety, because the vague dread becomes a specific set of sentences you can evaluate.
Half the anxiety of these conversations is the formlessness of them. Once you have actual words, you can look at them and think, is this cruel? It's just honest.
Honest is uncomfortable, but it's not cruel. Cruel is letting someone twist in the wind for 8 months while you hope they'll take a hint you're not actually sending.
The slow fade is the musical equivalent of beige wallpaper. It's designed to be inoffensive, but what it actually communicates is that you'd rather disappear than be seen.
The slow fade is a way of saying, I don't respect you enough to tell you the truth.
Which is a worse message than this friendship doesn't fit me anymore?
By a lot. And I think that's the reframe that helps people actually have these conversations. The thing you're afraid of, hurting someone, is actually more likely if you don't speak directly. The kindness paradox is real.
To summarize where we are, subtlety fails because the brain interprets ambiguous signals optimistically. Directness is actually kinder because it provides closure. And there's a concrete four-step framework. Gratitude bridge, I statement pivot, specific boundary, soft landing. That makes the conversation survivable for both parties.
If they push back, you use the broken record. Calm repetition without over-explaining. I hear you. I still need to step back.
What about the person who's listening and thinking? But I don't want to end the friendship. I just want it to be different. Is there a version of this for recalibrating rather than ending?
The framework works for recalibration too. The difference is in step 3, the specific boundary. Instead of, I won't be available for weekly calls, it's, I can't do weekly calls anymore, but I'd love to catch up once a month. You're naming the new terms rather than the exit.
The rest of the framework stays the same. Gratitude bridge, I statement pivot, soft landing.
The only thing that changes is whether the door is ajar or closed. But the clarity requirement is identical either way.
Because ambiguity is the enemy in both cases. Whether you're recalibrating or ending, the other person needs to know what the new reality is.
Recalibration is actually a great test case. If you say, I can only do once a month, and the person responds with respect and adjusts, you've learned something valuable. That friendship might have a future at a different frequency. If they push back and demand the old frequency, you've learned something too.
The recalibration conversation is almost a diagnostic tool. How someone responds to a reasonable boundary tells you everything you need to know about whether the friendship is worth keeping at any frequency.
There's one more thing I want to touch on, which is the anticipatory guilt. The thing that stops people from having these conversations isn't usually the conversation itself. It's the days or weeks of dreading the conversation. And that dread is almost always worse than the conversation.
The dread is the price you pay for the delay. The longer you wait, the more dread you accumulate.
The conversation itself, in most cases, is uncomfortable for maybe 10 minutes. Then it's done. Then you've reclaimed your time and energy, and the other person has clarity. The dread-to-relief ratio is wildly lopsided.
It's like pulling off a bandage. The anticipation is worse than the action.
Every time you have one of these conversations, you're not just ending or recalibrating a friendship. You're training your boundary muscle for the next one. The first conversation is the hardest. The fifth is notably easier. By the tenth, you've built a skill that serves you in every relationship you have.
Which is the open question worth sitting with? What if the friendship you're afraid to end is actually the one that's teaching you how to set boundaries?
That's a reframe that changes everything. The difficult friendship isn't just a burden. It's a training ground. It's the place where you learn that you can say a hard thing and survive. That someone can be upset with you and you'll be okay. That your needs are allowed to take up space.
Once you've done it once, you prove it to yourself that you can do it. The next time, the question isn't, can I? It's when.
I want to circle back to something from the research that I think ties this together. That 2023 Pew survey, 43% of adults under 35 have ended a friendship in the last 2 years. That's a massive number. It suggests that friendship churn is a normal part of adult life, not a personal failure.
Only 22% had the direct conversation, which means most people are ending friendships badly and probably don't even realize there's a better way.
That's the gap this framework is trying to fill. The cultural script for friendship endings doesn't exist, so we have to build it ourselves.
One script at a time.
And the script isn't about being cold or clinical. It's about being clear. Clarity is a form of respect. Ambiguity is a form of avoidance dressed up as kindness.
The inauthentic version of you protects you from the discomfort of being seen. It doesn't protect the other person from being hurt.
That's the thing. The version of you that sends vague texts and hopes the problem goes away, that version isn't protecting anyone. It's just buying time.
The bill always comes due.
If you're listening and you've got a friendship that's been weighing on you, do the exercise this week. Write the gratitude bridge. Write the I statement pivot. Don't send it. Just write it. See how it feels to have the words.
You might find that the words are less scary than the silence.
If you do end up having the conversation, you might find that the other person already knew something was off. People are more perceptive than we give them credit for. They're just waiting for us to say the thing.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In 1963, geologists on the Kuril Island of Kunashir discovered a rare fluorescent mineral called tugtupite that glows a vivid crimson under shortwave ultraviolet light, making it one of only three known minerals worldwide to exhibit tenebrescence, the ability to change color when exposed to light and then fade back in darkness.
Of course, that's a word.
You know, it's funny, a mineral that changes color in the light and fades in the dark. There's probably a metaphor in there about friendships and visibility, but I'm going to resist the urge to force it.
I think Hilbert just did the forcing for us.
This has been my Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. If this episode helped you, share it with someone who's been too nice for too long. We'll be back next week.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, my weird prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.